I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
The more you ignore me, the closer I get. You're wasting your time. The more you ignore me, the closer I get. You're wasting your time.
Is that you?
Yeah,
there he is.
1981 in my mum's front room.
I love it.
They used a shot similar. It was for a magazine called The Face.
Yeah, I remember The Face. Isn't The Face coming back or back?
Is it?
Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah, it's I think owned by the same company that do Mix Mag, and they also bought out Kerrang. And I think that's their now three flagship magazines. Because I guess Face was like the Vice, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was fashion and music. This is fashion with the trousers from Johnson's, and they do the picture of the band, and then they say where all our clothes came from.
Right.
Okay.
So what we're looking at here, obviously, because you won't be able to see this, is Polaroid photos from 1981 of a young rockabilly Boz Borah.
Well, I've been.
Look at the size of those trousers. That's amazing, isn't it?
28 waist. They didn't do bigger than a 32. Yeah, I've been going through some boxes and stuff that's up in the loft, trying to make a bit of room. And I'm not quite sure what to do with these, really. I just probably file them back away.
Have you done a book?
No.
Is it that something you consider doing? Was it something you'd like to do?
Yeah, I've talked about the guy, Michael, the ones, the label that I put my stuff out on called Fabric in Austria. He's always on about just having someone follow me around for a weekend.
Right.
And start writing things down.
Yeah. Well, and you just sort of dictate.
Silly little stories, because I don't remember them all.
You know? No. Well, I'm always amazed by that. Whenever I read anyone's autobiography, the level of detail that they go into from, you know, the early childhood years onwards, you know, is kind of astounding. I don't think I'd be able to recall all of my
childhood. Well, I've been reading the Ed to James stories. Book. I'm nearly at the end of it.
I remember you saying the other day, yeah.
And she's, I don't know how long that guy was with her, but it's covers
it's thorough.
Very thorough. Yeah.
And you were saying she was, I guess, someone who struggled a lot with substance abuse and... There you go.
A lot of demons, yeah.
Yeah. I guess a lot of those early jazz and blues singers were troubled artists, weren't they?
Well, we were listening to Chet Baker last night.
Yeah.
As I was drifting off, and he had a few demons.
That was kind of the drug of choice, wasn't it, within jazz, was heroin.
Yeah. I don't know
dark.
Why it was so... It was like something you had to do, you had to go for.
Yeah. So you were born 62, right, Boz?
Yep.
So let's talk about your early years, if you can remember them, on the subject of that. Were your parents into music? Was it a musical household you grew up in?
A little bit. My dad sang in a choir, and my mum played piano by ear, but her sister had the piano lessons, and she didn't. It should have been the other way around. And then at a very early age, I showed interest in music. My mum took a job at the school as a dinner lady to pay for my musical education. Started off on the recorder, and then I wanted to play the clarinet, but my hands weren't big enough, so I had to wait till they got bigger so I could learn the clarinet, and then the saxophone, and the guitar came along, and I learned classical guitar and studied music.
Wow, so you were a multi-instrumentalist from a very early age.
Yeah, it's all maths, really.
What was the inspiration behind wanting to learn the clarinet? Was that the likes of Chet Baker, or...?
No, it was... I was watching the TV And my mum said, do you want to play a new instrument? And I said, yeah, I want to play that. And it was Kenny Ball and his Jasmine.
Okay.
And she said, the trumpet, which is what Kenny Ball played. And I said, no, what that bloke's playing in the background. And I don't remember being drawn to it, but obviously I was. And that was a clarinet.
We've spoke about this a few times. T-Rex, would it be safe to say, were the band that really drove you into starting a rock and roll path? Or was there a few?
No, I love pop music. And I think it was Mark Bonan that was the first person that made me want to do something like that. The power that the electric guitar had and everything that came with it, pop music. I thought that, as I say, I was a fan from about the age of 8 or maybe 8 years old. And then I first heard Hot Love and Get It On would have been 71. And then I started playing guitar when I was about 12, 74. So it's just a gradual growth, really.
And was glam, like, was the aesthetic and the imagery of glam something that ignited a fire in you as well?
Oh, yeah. I loved all those Sweet and Slade, Bowie, T-Rex. I loved it. That's the start of it. And then it went a bit rockabilly.
Right. So rockabilly came before punk, did it for you?
And then punk came on.
Right. And a very quick succession.
Yes.
Well, bang, bang,
yeah,
bang.
I had a quiff and I'd be going to punk gigs at the Roundhouse. So I'd have to beat myself up on a regular basis.
And who were the out of the punk bands? And did you start the Polecats? Was it 77?
We started rehearsing. Our first gig was at a party in very early 78. Probably February, around early February. We played punk and we played rock and roll.
And did you fit seamlessly on both bills? Because I guess it was that time when...
Nah, not really.
No?
No, we...
Which crowds were more receptive to you? Were you too punk for rockabilly and too rockabilly for punk? Or
yeah.
So was there
just
a bit of that?
We just went with rockabilly in the end.
You did?
Yeah.
Is that because the punks just were kind of, I guess, when punk first started, it was either you're pure punk or you're not punk. Was that the criticism that you guys came across?
Because we only played little gigs back then. We didn't really play any major gigs until maybe 1980. So in 78 and 79, we were just playing in people's little pubs and... There wasn't really a scene that we fitted onto.
Were you one of the first bands then in the UK to be sort of taking on that genre in a new, energetic,
rockabilly as it was, came out. Kinda. The young kids, they didn't really play Teddy Boy rock and roll anymore. That's what we started off playing.
Yeah.
But we started to play more authentic, what we thought was authentic sounding rockabilly. And it had that punk edge to it and was electrified. And so it became what they now call neo-rockabilly.
Right.
Not really psychobilly, which is more punk.
So who did you play with in those early years that would stand out as the key bands of that time?
I just saw a flyer for a gig that we did supporting Matchbox at the Music Machine. I think that was February 1980. That was our first sort of big show. We played Teddy Boy pubs and clubs, which was quite an odd thing because we weren't really Teddy Boy. There was an agent called Paul Barrett who sadly just died yesterday. I've been reading his tributes today.
All right.
But he managed Crazy Cav and he managed Shaking Stevens and he had a huge rock and roll agency that every rock and roll musician was on, you know. When I managed Alan Wilf, he was getting Wilf gigs. So,
now.
That's my wife's phone.
It's hidden somewhere in there.
I woke up this morning. Now.
You're looking for trouble.
So our gigs got bigger and bigger. And then I think we managed, when the Stray Cats came over, it's helped us to break down the door, really. They got a lot of press, and we were doing the same sort of thing, and it enabled us to get to a wider audience and eventually with a recording contract.
And did you go over stateside as well? Did the Polecats manage to make inroads over there?
We played three gigs in New York, and we really should have played more gigs in a lot of different places. We should have gone to LA when we had Make a Circuit was a hit on K-Rock. Maybe that was in 82.
Were you aware that it was?
Not really.
No.
A little bit. It was Richard Blake came over and did a TV show, and we went down and met up with him and did some filming. And he said he'd been playing it all the time. But now, well, I go to the States a lot, and a lot of people remember it from the 80s as being part of the K-Rock thing.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it was recently, well, not that recently, but fairly recently used in that Wally film trailer, wasn't it?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. It was, that shows you how, you know, how
ingrained it was, yeah.
It's weird. Great.
I guess that would have been the case with a lot of bands around that time, right? Pre-internet, when it was harder to keep tracks on sales and markets and territories, is a lot of bands probably didn't realise, oh, we should have definitely gone there.
We should have gone to Japan.
We missed the boat.
We didn't go to Japan. I just found someone was at the Utrecht Record Fair last year and bought me a South African John O'May dancing polecats. Never knew it existed. 40 years after the fact. Brilliant.
And that's someone who spends a lot of time travelling record shops around the world.
I mean, digging deep. Yeah, I've just spent my whole time in record stores and I never knew it existed. So I'm still finding things out.
So you use the app called, what's the vinyl app you use? Because we need to give that a plug to help people.
Oh, yeah. It's called...
So for anyone who doesn't know, Boz owns a record shop in Camden called Vinyl Boutique. And I presume your main hobby outside of making music is probably tracing down records.
Yeah, I never stop.
Worldwide, right?
I never stop. But this is just some of the things that are lying around. But I'm always got my nose in the internet finding... So this is the Vinyl District.
And that's a free app you get.
Yep.
All smartphones.
And if you press stores in Toxico Records, which is 2 miles away, and then Vinyl Boutique.
There you go.
4 miles away. Click on it.
So you get into any kind of city or country, load that up.
You can be going on the motor. I did it on the motorways somewhere in Poland somewhere.
Yeah, yeah.
And it said the nearest record shop was in Warsaw, 140 miles away. Sometimes in weird places. It will just as a crow flies and show you someone that's 1,000 miles away, because it's the nearest. When I was in Costa Rica, yeah, it's fun and it's got reviews. And when I was in Sweden trying to find a prog rock store, it was on a side street and I couldn't find it. And when I put this on, it showed me another 2 shops that I didn't know about.
Right.
So it's very.
So it's definitely worth it. And it's funny because I think that people are probably of the common. Perhaps misconception that vinyl stores are dying out, but that's not necessarily the case, is it?
Oh, I think
chain stores are certainly struggling, but
oh, the individual stores definitely growing.
They're hanging on in there as well. Some of these old.
When I go into Lisbon now, I went in the other day, but I didn't do any record shopping. But when I looked at the app, there was a lot more stores than there was 5 years ago.
Because people seem to be going really crazy for vinyl, don't they, at the moment, and have been for a few years now.
Well, yeah, it's for the youngsters, it's a new thing.
Yep.
And for the older generation, it's a return to something that they knew and loved when they were younger.
I think in this digital world as well, where everything is very digital and throwaway, there's something to be said for something which is a bit nostalgic. It's weighty. It's kind of, you know, it's tangible. You can hold it. It's almost like a piece of art.
Oh, definitely.
And the sound quality, I think, is... For certain records, anyway, that were made to be played on vinyl, the sound quality is vastly superior, isn't it?
I think it is. A long time ago, one of my records came out and I got it on CD and vinyl. When I put the two on, I thought the vinyl sounded, I A-B'd them through the same system, and I thought that the vinyl sounded better, even if the CD maybe had more clarity within the tracks. I don't know whether I'm just used to hearing things a little bit more muddy.
Yeah.
And I've got drawers of that top drawer is just full of CDs. I don't like the cases, so I throw them away because they take up too much room.
Oh, and you put them in little wallets, do you?
Yeah, there's thousands. And that box down there is the same, full of CDs, not in cases. So there's, pardon me, but I've got them all on my iTunes, so I don't really play CDs anymore.
Yeah, well, you know, CDs I think are definitely dying. Like laptops, for instance, now they don't even have a CD drive.
Oh no, it's annoying.
It is really annoying.
From my little Mac up there, I had to
you get
go
the
and buy
external.
I had to go and buy an
plug
external,
in.
And that's so old that my Mac guy said, "It's not worth putting anything, and not worth bothering with. It's not gonna, because it just won't handle any of the modern
Yeah.
Applications.
Well, I find with that product in particular as well, is they're designed, I think, with inbuilt flaws to only last a few years and then...
For the next year's thing. In there. Well, they've already got next year's thing, but they're not telling you until next year.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The slow drip feed release.
Yeah, they got me. They got me a long time ago.
So what happened with Polecats? How long did you exist and last as a lineup first time around?
Well, I started playing in a band with my wife called the Shillelagh Sisters.
How did you and Lynn meet?
She used to come to Polecat gigs.
So she was kind of very much in the scene as well?
Yeah. Yeah, she was... I mean, we knew a lot of the same people. We worked out that she said she was at the Chuck Berry gig, I think it was in 76 or maybe 77, at the New Victoria Theatre with the Flying Saucers and the Pirates. And I said, oh, what show did you go to? Because I went to the early show. She went, I went to both of them. She was on the way out and someone said, I've got a spare ticket. Do you want to, you know, so we were at the same gig.
Amazing.
But we didn't know each other.
And how was that show? I'd have absolutely killed to have seen.
I mean, he was young and he was on form. And the Flying Saucers, I loved. They were a Teddy Boy rock and roll band. And they're still playing in a format. But I was a big fan of them as well. So I had a great night.
So you and Lynn start making music together after you fall for each other.
So we had a band called the Shillelagh Sisters. I taught her to play double bass. And the singer was a girl called Jackie O'Sullivan, who we were in contact with. We just bought a house over in Portugal. And we're still in contact with her. And she, when she left, she joined Bananarama.
Oh, right. She
was the new girl in Bananarama. So I started playing with them, and Polecats didn't really do much. So I left the Polecats, and we had a lot of work on with Shillelagh Sisters, signed to CBS. We had a couple of singles. Did a tour with Spirit Destiny. And so I did that. So we... And then we played, I think, our first gig we played back together, I think, was probably in about 88 in Holland, at a festival in Horen. It's a bit hazy. I can't... It might have been earlier than that, though.
And didn't Tim go over to do some stuff with Slim Jim
from the Stray Cats? Tim moved to America.
Yeah.
In the 80s. And... he moved to LA and now he's down in Palm Springs. So he's always got little projects on the go. So he did a thing with Slim Jim. He did a band called 13 Cats with Slim Jim and Smutty Smith from the Rockettes and Danny B. Harvey. And he did that for a while.
Have you never been tempted by the stateside move?
Yeah. Yeah. But we didn't do it.
No.
We thought about it a couple of times.
Is that because you just love London too much? It feels like home, or?
Well,
I just don't like America enough to want to move there.
I think that's what it was, really. And the ties that we have with family in England.
And you've got the kids now who've obviously grown up and flown the nest.
Well, Billy's flown to Australia.
Literally.
Couldn't be further from the nest. Well, unless they colonise the moon. She could get further away. But now Lynn's going to go overseas in March. And
the ones down in Brighton at uni.
Yeah. Yeah, Pearl's down in uni. She was supposed to come back yesterday, but she didn't make
no sign. So when do you get the call from Mozza to start playing with him? Is that 91?
Yeah, I was. We'd been on a holiday in this mad group of us. We decided it was eight couples, and I think there were six kids. And we said, we're all going to go on holiday together. And we're going to go to...
You got a picture of the vacation there.
I did see some pictures in one of these books. We went to Crete.
Yeah. Beautiful part of the world.
Better. And Carl from Madness came with us, who I only met on the plane going out. So there was four couples and six kids, and we just sort of took over. And
what, you in that big house?
Well, it was these little apartments.
Yeah. And there he is.
Hi.
How you doing?
Hello, Pearl. Just talked about you.
Speak of the devil.
On a podcast.
Are you doing it right now?
Yes.
Oh,
and so Carl from Madness, Chess Mash, we got to be friends, and he knew Morrissey. And he phoned me one day. I was working as a recording engineer for Chrysalis Publishing, a job I had for about 6 years, and recording all their demos.
So that was full time, was it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that was my day job. That's what I did. The music dried up, so I became an engineer.
Were you always fascinated with that side of the business as well from the start? Or was
no,
it just something you sort
I
of learned
like
on
it
the...
to begin with. It seemed, when I was a kid, it seemed too laboured. I just wanted to play the songs.
You wanted to be in the moment on stage.
But as time's gone on, it's now my favourite.
Is it really?
Yeah, of all the processes, is the recording process.
Is that because that appeals? You mentioned the word, it's all maths earlier. Is that because that appeals to that side of your brain?
Yeah, it's the most inventive. And if I'm not playing, I want to draw playing out of people as a producer. Or if I'm recording, I can do anything I like. I can reach into different instruments and sounds and construct something from a guitar and a click track up to a full orchestrated track.
So you like that scientific element of being in the lab, cooking up?
Yes, it's my favourite now. So then Carl phoned me one day and said, come out for lunch. I said, yeah, sure. He said, it's with Clive Langer, the producer. I said, oh, cool. He said, and Morrissey. I said, well, fine. And I think that they've been talking about writing songs, and Carl had stuck my name in the pot. So we went down and had dinner in Notting Hill, which is near where the studio was. And a short time after that, I went to Hook End Manor and we recorded Pregnant for the Last Time, the Morrissey single. And Johnny Bridgewood played double bass, and Alan White came and played some piano and mouth organ. And Mark Nevin was there, and the drummer, whose name escapes me at the moment, was playing on plastic tubes, like tom-toms. And then it all went quiet after that had been done. And then...
So it was never like an official offer to start with. It was
it was talked about a band with Mark Nevin without anybody, just with me joining on second guitar, the band that was there. And then that all went away. And then he found the other players who I knew them all, Spencer, Gary and Alan. And Mark Nevin left and they offered me the job, which I still have today.
It's crazy, isn't it? So what's it been now? Almost 30 years, is it?
Yeah, it's 20. What are we in now? 19.
Yeah.
So it's 28 years.
28 years. I mean, you must have seen firsthand some quite extreme stuff on stage and the fans' reactions.
Oh, yeah.
To him at that point in particular, right?
Oh, the
flaying
Santa
themselves
Monica
on stage and
all the chairs that were piled up on the stage, Santa Monica. We only played about 15 minutes, complete riot. Lovely, beautiful.
Yeah.
But the gigs after that then became a bit heavy politically. If anyone gets on the stage, we're going to shut the gig down, and the amount of ambulances were there in case anyone got hurt. It got quite heavy at one point.
It's interesting as well because a lot of those fans, I guess, were and probably continue to be male, right? And that's quite a unique thing that he has, I think, that not many other artists have, is almost this appeal over, if you want to call it, heterosexual
like
males.
Like a lads band.
Yeah.
Well, that's,
but expressing themselves in almost
The Pogues, Madness, The Faces, they're all kind of like lads bands. But it does change. It's really... really odd. We go to different countries and we'll say, did you notice the amount of young girls that were at the front of the gig? It was like predominantly older, it changes.
Well, let me ask you about this, because one of my favourite areas of the Morrissey fan base and the most fascinating to me is the Latino.
Oh, yeah.
And obviously there's that great band Mexrissey,
yeah,
that covers songs in that style. How does that start? Is that just because of his move over to the States and his exposure over there within perhaps those kind of Latino communities within LA, and then it just spread from there?
Yes, I would assume so. I mean, I can't place it down to one reason or one
song
or one occasion, but it grew very fast between his heartfelt lyrics and the Mexican culture. They just took him to heart. And it's a lovely thing to behold.
And do you do a lot of shows in South America?
Yeah.
Oh, we just, and they're Massive, are they?
That was our last show. Yeah, Mexico's kind of mainstream pop over there. We are trying to think the last place we played, Chile, and that's come up as being quite mental now as well. It's like things go in waves. Chile was mental.
I guess that imagery as well. It's very in line with that culture, isn't it? The sort of silhouette of his face and that kind of, you know, snappy dresser kind of,
yeah,
chic. I think we've style.
Yeah, we've embraced all the Mexican culture as well with the skulls and
yeah,
and all that, which I really
the
love.
Day of the Dead sort of stuff. Yeah,
I
yeah,
love all that. There's a little one up there. Look.
Yeah, there you go.
Adamant gave me.
So when does that relationship start?
With Adam?
Yeah.
When I was working at Chrysalis, I did all the demos for a band called Max, which was Kevin Mooney, who was the bass player in the Kings of the Wild Frontier lineup of Adam and the Ants. And Marco did all of the guitaring. So Marco would come in and basically work out what was happening with the bass and the vocal and lay down some great guitaring. So I got to know him quite well. And he lived just around the corner. And then one day, out of the blue, he phoned me up and said, would I go around his house and have a meeting? And Adam was there, and Dave Ruffy, who I'd met once.
I love Dave Ruffy. What a sweetheart he is.
Yeah, I'd met him once, because he played with Kirsty McColl, who was a friend of ours, and was married to Steve Lillywhite, who was also a friend of mine, because he'd produced records with Morrissey.
Yeah, he did. What did he do? He did the...
Fox
everything
I,
from Vox
Fox
on
I, Southpaw Grammar, and Maladjusted.
And
I had some time off, so when I did a small tour of America, and then
what year was this? Or years?
92 or 93.
Okay.
Came back, wrote some.
So it's
songs.
Around the same time as when you joined Morrissey. So that's a busy period in your life.
Yeah, it's probably a couple of years later, probably 93, and I did the American tour. Then we wrote a load of songs. Then we made an album called Wonderful. And then I couldn't do the Wonderful tour.
Because of Morrissey commitments.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, always comes first. But we've stayed friends. I saw him at Christmas at the Round House.
Oh, I love that track that you did with him on vocals. What was it? Jungle Rock.
Oh, yeah.
That's a fun little number, that is.
Yeah, that was...
Is the video the official video? You know, that one with all the women in the sort of set with the leaves?
Oh, no, that's taken off of Top of the Pops.
Oh, right, okay.
That's Pan's People.
Yeah, yeah,
I think
yeah, yeah.
Dance in the Jungle Rock by Hank Mazzell.
Right.
Which was a hit in 75 or something. It's an old rockabilly song. And I think someone's taken the film of Pan's People Dancing
to that
and put
it
mine
to,
on it.
It works, doesn't it?
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. That's when I had a little studio across the road. I loved the little basement underneath the community centre. And I'd just go there and just flick a switch and everything would come on and I'd make music. It was a drum kit in the back.
And is it you singing on that as well?
Doing backing vocals.
Right.
Oh, no. Oh, it is me singing. He does backing vocals.
He does backing. Yeah,
yeah,
he always
singing.
Do you enjoy singing?
Sometimes.
Yeah?
Not all the time. I haven't got a great voice.
You see yourself more as a player than a singer then, do you?
Yeah.
Yeah?
Yeah, arranger.
What's the first song you and Morrissey co-write together?
Jack the Ripper.
And which album was that on? Was that Vauxhall?
It was a B-side of Certain People I Know. I'd given him songs, nothing that struck a chord with him.
Did you have any input on the writing or arrangements on Your Arsenal? Or were you just a kind of player at that point?
I was the band leader. Me and Mick Ronson played recorders on it. Trying to remember the sessions. They were mainly live.
How was that working with Mick Ronson as someone who'd grown up?
It was great.
Loving glam.
Yeah, he was a great man.
Yeah?
Yeah, you can't really say enough about him, really. It was a joy to be around. It was just and I spent quite a lot of time with it because we started off recording at Utopia Studios around the back of Primrose Hill, and that was closing down, so it was a bit of a ghost studio. And then we went round to Mayfair in Primrose, round the corner, and then we went to the Wall Hall near Bristol, and then we went to Hook End and did all the mixing and finishing off there. So I spent quite a lot of time with him. We used to get the Sporting Post in the morning and work out our bets, and we go into town and do little weird little Yankee bits. And it's good.
And the sound of that album is very glam and rockabilly inspired, isn't it?
Yeah.
So it must have really stuck well with both your styles.
Yeah, it was perfect. It was, even though I didn't have any songs on it, but that was my kind of arranging head, really.
Yeah.
And how we would play. Things like, you're going to need somebody on your side with the and the those great chords strummed at the end. Yeah, good days.
Because I was watching a documentary on Morrissey the other day, and a lot of people were saying he works in this really interesting way that you'll say go to him with a template of a song, and it'll be like intro, verse, chorus, verse, bridge, and then he'll sort of not approach it in that way, will he? He'll go, let's actually use the verses, maybe the intro, and then you sort
definitely
of...
there's no rules. What you thought was a chorus and what, just be an instrumental section. nothing on it whatsoever. Or it might go.
Yeah,
it might get booted out. What you thought was the great hook that you'd written might end up on the cutting room floor.
What is the first co-write?
Did you ever see the promo of it?
No. I'd love to.
Promo is fantastic. So, I don't know if you're aware of the T-Rex covers that look exactly like that.
Yeah. Wow. Moz. So it's very much in that.
So that's like the T-Rex. The T-Rex cover is exactly the same as the picture of Bolan on. So that's the Certain People with Jack the Ripper on the other side.
That's very cool.
But these are very hard to find now.
He's always had great sleeves, hasn't he?
Yeah.
And what's that? Oh, that's an old ticket, is it?
That's the first gig I ever did with Morrissey. So I don't know why they're in there. But they're in...
Memories, isn't it?
Yeah, well, trying to boost the memories.
Yeah.
memory full, I think.
Mental clues. What was the gig where the enemy went after him and started criticising him for wrapping the flag around him?
That happened at Finsbury Park at the Madness shows. It was all around the same time, really, 91, 92.
Because of that track as well. Because it's funny with artists like that, because they don't overtly, do you know what I mean, say this is wrong. You know, if you try and approach a subject like that in an intelligent way, you often get accused of, you know, sympathising with the thing that you're actually condemning.
Well, I can't really talk for Morrissey.
Yeah. But that song is a very sympathetic song, isn't it? Just observing basically the downfall of a young boy and...
Yeah.
It's not going, oh, let's celebrate this.
We've lost our boy.
Yeah. Do you think that's just journalists trying to gun for a scoop?
Well, they seem to do it all the time. It's just relentless, really. I'm quite fortunate it doesn't happen to me.
Do you think that was part of him moving to LA then? Was just, I've had enough of the British media?
I don't know. As I said, I can't really talk for him.
Surefire way to escape, isn't it? And just not have to put up with that bullshit and just enjoy a lot quieter life.
I don't know.
Let's talk about, Boz, if you don't mind, the Bowie tour.
Oh, yeah.
How was that for you, again, as a young glam child? I know you didn't do the complete tour, but well, the shows that you did do together.
We did the four nights at Wembley, and the little bar there afterwards became my local for a week, which is quite weird. I mean, I hate to be one to moan, but the first show, I believe that we had to use their lights, which were set for him and not for us. So they weren't on us. They were set at the wrong angles.
Because you were obviously in front
and
of where his band
knew
were going to play.
We were going, when we were going on. And so the first gig wasn't very good, really, but it got better.
On paper, that bill for me, and if it happened today, if he was obviously still around, would be perfection. But did the fans of those two camps gel and sort of, or was it very much a case of Smiths fans in one corner and Morrissey fans and then
I don't know.
Bowie fans in the other?
I remember it being bad. I remember my mum going to it.
Yeah.
And my dad said, take a video camera and film some of it. And of course, you got stopped going in.
Because they would have been massive cameras in those times, yeah.
Boss, your mum's you have to go and take a camera off of it because they're not allowing her in with a video camera. And then I remember someone going, here, are you Bozzy's mum? It's quite funny. There's no footage of her, so she couldn't film anything.
How is David? Did you get many one-on-one moments with him?
Nah, not really. I spoke to him a few times. He came in the dressing room a couple of times.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Who's been some of your other favourite people you've had the chance to sort of write and create with? Was Kirsty McCall a highlight for you?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
What a talent she was.
We loved Kirsty. We used to go down to her house a lot in Mount Park Road in Ealing. She was always having parties, and there was always interesting people. Victor Spinetti, I spent some time with him once. It was quite just odd, bizarre. And the time that Lynn rubbed wasp ease on Lionel Bart's head, he'd been upstairs, the kids were playing table tennis, and the ball had gone somewhere, and he got underneath and he banged his head. He came downstairs, and Lynn was taller than Kirstie, so she could look in the cupboard. And he said, "Oh, banged my head. Is there anything for a banged head?" And Lynn went, "Oh, let's have a look. Oh, there's some wasp ease." And he said, "Well, that'll do." So Lynn applied wasp ease to Lionel Bart's head. Very odd, but, you know.
And did it have any positive or healing effect?
I don't know. I just thought it was a lovely, weird thing that would only happen at Kirstie's house.
Yeah.
So Kirsty was great. Edwin Collins, who's moved up to Scotland, but his studio used to be just down the road here. And I used to go down and watch him record. And I did some work there. I played on a track or two with him. And then I did a tour with him a few years back on keyboards and sax.
Nice. That was a bit of a change of pace for you then, is it?
Yes. Enjoyable. He had the two strokes in MRSA. And if you ever think you're having a bad day, you know, he's quite inspirational with a young Edwin. Haven't seen him for a while. Hopefully I'll see him soon. Adam's great. As I say, I saw him at the Roundhouse. Very, very nice to see him back playing in front of a lot of people and making music again. Yeah, going through all this stuff, there was a couple of letters from him from a few years ago. And he gave me that Day of the Dead thing there.
Yeah, yeah.
I thought I might like it. And there's a massive Elvis poster. See where it says Adam Ant box set up there?
Yep. Above that.
There's a massive Elvis poster it's big, probably as big as that carpet from one of the films from the 60s. I saw it, thought I might like it. I think it's French. But no, I love him. He's a lovely bloke.
After Morrissey does move to the States, and I guess there's quite a big intermission between the Maladjusted album and You Are the Quarry, is that when you start getting more into production? Because you've got a bit more time on your hands. Or were you still touring during that time, even though records weren't being released?
We did play quite a lot.
Because he was without a record label, wasn't he, for quite a while as well?
Yeah, it was about 7 years between that and Quarry. But we still played.
So touring was still a constant.
Yeah, there's been a couple of years where we've not played at all, like whole years. But that's in the 28 years. So, I mean, to take some time off, I think, is a good thing.
There's not many artists from his generation that have continued to be as prolific with releases and touring and to have really stayed true to who they are as an artist and to have the quality remain at an almost consistent level, is there?
Well, yeah. I mean, I'm
few
surprised.
And far between.
I'm surprised I'm still managing to have hit records at my young age. You know? And it's a great thing.
And being on shows, obviously, like Jonathan Ross when Quarry was out, and then Larry King, and doing these cool television spots as well.
Yeah, they keep coming. We just did James Corden over in LA.
The Late Late Show, is it called? Yeah. Yeah. Did you ever do Top of the Pops back in the day?
Yeah, I did.
Yeah.
Twice with the Polecats, and then we did it with Morrissey. They're easy days. They're quite long, but they're not really that hard work.
Is it a similar experience to shooting a music video?
No, because it's a really short burst of 3-4 minutes, and your adrenaline goes through you, and you settle in by the end of it, and then you're off, and it's done. It's and then you sort of like wanting more, really, but it's only 4 minutes.
It's a one take deal, is it?
Normally, yeah. We normally don't mess about. I think the last couple of TVs that we've done, in and out, just, you know, no point in hanging about if you know what you're doing. Easy.
What have been some of your favourite songs that you've written with Morrissey, if you had to pick a couple?
It was an unreleased song called Kit that I really liked that didn't get to see the light of day.
Are there a lot of those?
No. Not really, no. A few have come out. And I always like the latest thing that we've been doing. I like Jackie. I like all the young people, Must Fall in Love. I like the variety, that they don't ever belong to one genre.
Yeah,
absolutely. They can be folky or they can be really heavy and anything in between. So I don't really have favourites. It tends to be the things that we're doing most recently and moving ahead and moving on.
Do you have any favourites from the live side that you particularly enjoy performing live?
Again, that changes and tends to be the newest songs that we're doing. They might be old songs, but if we haven't played them, it's always exciting to put a new song in the set. I'm trying to think of the most recent one. Break Up the Family, we hadn't played that for a long time. It's an old song, but it was new to a lot of people in the audience. When we did a song called Fantastic Bird that was unreleased from Your Arsenal, but came out on a subsequent release, it was a whole, for us, it was a new song. I don't think I'd heard it for 30 years.
Yeah.
It's good.
From like a gearhead point of view, I don't play guitar, so, you know, I'm not going to be able to ask you any really technical expert questions, but if you could share some of your favourite guitars and models that you use with anybody who's listening who might be particularly interested in that side of you, because obviously you're known as a guitar man.
Well, the electric guitar that I believe has magic powers is the 63 Telecaster that I play.
Right.
And I don't know why, but I've never found anything that sounds the same as it. The first Fender was a Broadcaster, I think, in 1952, but they couldn't use Broadcaster because Gretsch were using it on a drum kit. So then it had no name, which is called a no-caster. Then it became a Telecaster. And 63 was the pre-CBS years. For some reason, it's that particular guitar. I don't know what happened to it when it was made, but it's got a mojo. I have a Martin D45 acoustic that I don't use an awful lot, but it every now and again it gets used a lot and then it doesn't. And I think that's probably one of the greatest acoustic sounds. Although I have a Gibson SJ200 that I quite like. And I mean, there's a Gretsch Kingman over there, which is not really expensive, but it sounds quite nice. I use it here for working on tunes.
And that is an acoustic, is it?
Yeah.
But it almost looks like it has an electric head.
It has a Stratocaster headstock. And it depends on what songs we're playing. I change guitars on every number. So they're in tune. When they're given to me, it's in tune. So when I finish that song, I take another guitar and that's in tune. So there's probably three or four Telecasters. And then particular songs have particular guitars. For instance, Istanbul is played on a Gretsch.
You need to get that.
Yeah, it might be my electrician. It might be a little bit early. It's that.
There you go. What is that?
I don't know. Something my wife's ordered.
Is it just one of those big pillows, like a cushion?
No, no, we're going to have this floor redone. Because it's never been right. And it's a little bit damp underneath. So we're going to have the whole lot taken up and a new floor put in.
Very
so
nice.
That's probably sealant to go underneath the tiles. There you go.
There we go. Have you always had the same guitar tech?
Oh, no.
No?
No, I've they change about every 3 years.
Right.
Munch was the first. He was a guitarist in Tenpole Tudor when they had two guitarists. And there's been a steady, as I say, probably about five or six. Gavin's my current one. He's been with me for about 3 years. Lloyd was an old friend of mine from the 80s. We were in a band called the Blubbery Hellbillies.
And that's
moved
a great
to the
name.
States, and he did my teching for a while. There's been a few others in between.
I guess pedals is another area that we should touch upon very quickly
pedals.
As well. Because I saw a tutorial that you did for Boss on YouTube.
That was very popular. I didn't think it was going to be that popular.
Yeah, it had about 50,000 views. It's you going through the entire box, and there's a hell of a lot of them.
I'll do one of those, and I thought I was just being friendly. I didn't think that anyone would be interested in it.
Yeah, yeah.
But there's not many in here, because I've...
So Boz is digging into... Oh, wow, there you go. That is a treasure chest of pedals, ladies and gents.
So these are mainly things that I have that don't get out much, like the electro-harmonic baseballs. Is an auto wah. There's an old dynamic filter, which is also a wah. There's an air synth that I used on the beginning of the Munich air disaster. There's a Fender phaser, which lights up blue. It's a blue. My old SR16 drum machine, which I used in all my demos back in the day, including Jack the Ripper, that would have been done on that. The Dan Armstrong pedals, the little ones, they plug into the guitar. They're a little strange. Because they plug into the
guitar. And it just sits on the body.
And then you plug out of there. I remember these when I was a kid in the 70s. So I started to collect them, but they started to go up in price. I've got a few of them. So yes, I like pedals. And I like Boss. They're very kind to me at the moment.
Yeah, they hook you up.
I went down and saw them. Last week,
yeah, just after we met, wasn't it, when you're talking about going down?
That's right, yeah. We went down and an echo called a DM2, which is an old analog echo, and I've just had one break on me, and I use it on Jack the Ripper. So I've got an alternative one that we bought cheaper in Ventura, but it's not the same.
Yeah.
So I've got a new one ordered.
Isn't it funny how, because of the craftsmanship involved with things like this, that you just can't replace it for whatever reason, can you?
Well, they're all different.
Yeah.
And even some of the early pedals, there's a thing called a Funk Machine, and every single one is different. It's like that if you look at online, it all depends which one you get. A bit like Vox AC30s.
Which one couldn't you live without if you could only have one pedal?
Probably a compressor. A lot of people don't use them, but I use them a lot. Jingle jangle, string picking thing. I don't know when I started. Probably started with Morrissey using them. But a compressor, I have a compressor on all the time. And an acoustic simulator, which makes the sound of an acoustic, and that goes through all the time. So I'm always compressed, and I've always got an acoustic sound in the background. Because when we started recording, I would do an acoustic or an electric rhythm, and then I'd do the same thing on an acoustic. So when we played live, I was thinking, well, it's not getting the whole sound. So that's when I started using the acoustic simulator. So when I'm playing a rhythm, it also sounds, so you get the acoustic sound as well.
There you go. Tricks of the trade. Can we talk at all about the latest and up-and-coming record?
We did an album of covers, and I think it's coming out in May. And it's about American 60s songwriters.
And the title is Common Knowledge.
California Sun.
Yeah.
Spelled S-O-N. That's it, really. I mean, I love it, but, you know. I think the track listing is Common Knowledge.
Yeah, and, It's, well, Joni Mitchell and the likes, Carole King and Roy Orbison.
It's quite incredible, really, because a lot of those songs were just done with an acoustic and someone singing. And to do them as a band and to arrange them was a great thing. I think it's a stunning album.
And will that be toured, or is that as yet to be determined?
I don't know. I don't know at all. I don't know from one day to the other.
And do you and Morrissey have a lot of shared common tastes in songwriters and in music? And do you have similar, you know, key touchstones in your wall of inspiration?
Morrissey always amazes me. His knowledge is so vast that he amazes me sometimes with things I've never heard of. I have to go and look up and play and listen to. So he's definitely guided me in listening to a lot of music.
So you've got this interview coming up in a moment where you've got to talk about 10 albums you couldn't live without, or your 10 all-time top favourites.
Yes.
Give us a taste of what's in this list. I know it's not yet quite complete. It's missing the final piece.
Well, there'd be Electric Warrior by T-Rex, Ooh La La by the Faces, Sticky Fingers by the Rolling Stones, The Elvis Sun Sessions, Living Wonder Bollocks by the Pistols, The Scream, Susie and the Banshees.
Okay, yeah, right. What is it about that? Just the landscapes of music?
I love Susie and the Banshees. And before they signed a deal, I had all the John Peel sessions that I would have on a cassette player at school. I saw them at the Roundhouse in 77 with the Buzzcocks. I saw them in 78. And their music was just it didn't have any rules. It sort of showed me that you could do what you wanted, really. And it could be jagged, and it could whoop, and it could have odd tribal drumming that didn't make any sense. It was, I loved that first Banshees album.
It was The Scream, the first one. Yeah. Nicotine Stain is a song I like on that. That's good.
Yeah, that was because I knew most of the songs on it. There were a few, that was one of the new ones, and Suburban Relapse, Switch, and I can't think now. Probably Pure, that first, the instrumental.
Jigsaw Feeling, is that a song on that album?
That was a new one as well, yeah. Yeah, I love that record, and Steve Lillywhite produced it. And then an album by a band called Tupelo Chainsex called What Is It, which is a mad jazz, rockabilly, punk,
right,
dub.
All of it.
A mad mixture, which then showed me then more ways to go. There were definitely weren't any rules, and you could mix anything you wanted to mix together. That was an album that I know inside out. Probably one of the MCA Rare rockabilly albums, which has got Hank Garland playing guitar on most of it.
And that is the...
How many is that?
That's the 9, I think.
Is that 9?
I think we stopped counting at Susie, but I think you were at 6 on Susie.
I've made notes.
And we've got to get this last one decided now, Boz.
Mothballs, Draft Excluder.
I never heard that.
Gretsch Princess, Elvis Sun Sessions, The Scream, What is it? Never mind the bollocks. School's out. Alice Cooper, yeah.
Love it.
Sticky Fingers. And I put the White Album. Another album that I know inside. I learned all my acoustic guitar from The Beatles Complete. So I started off with simple, someone like Eleanor Rigby, and ended up with things like Sexy Sadie or the finger picking on Her Majesty. So I knew a lot of Beatles songs. And when I was a kid at school, I bought Beatles records off anyone that would sell me them at school. So they come in and I give them £1 and they give me Please Please Me or Beatles for Sale or With the Beatles. And Neil Spanbox sold me a mono copy of the White Album for 50p because it wasn't in very good condition.
Well, who was your mate we were with the other day who said it was, well, actually the guy who works in your shop, and he said it was all downhill after Please Please Me or something.
Andy Hackett. No, after the Live at the Star Club. Yeah. Yeah, it went downhill after Live at the Star Club, which I mentioned to him the other day when I saw him on Saturday. I thought it was funny. It was a good comment.
How did the White Album do at the time of its release? Was it just too out there for a lot of people at that time? Because it was obviously so expansive, wasn't it? And you had almost like precursors to grunge and heavy metal and all these.
I don't know how it went down, but it sold a lot in a lot of countries. I've got several copies of it from different places. So that's when I got that album. And I like every track on it. Even the weird Revolution #9, with all that #9.
Yeah.
My brother had Let It Be, Abbey Road, Help, and Sergeant Pepper, which I used to steal and play. I've just got the box set of Let It Be up there.
I saw that on my way in. Not that I was being nosy, but I did clock that.
Look at that. Found in a shop.
Now, was that the last album they recorded, or was it the last album they released?
It was the last album they released.
Released. So released. Abbey Road was recorded after that, was it?
Yes. Because Spectre, I found this in a shop in Amersham last weekend. But it didn't have that. And it didn't
It's in
have,
pretty decent condition,
isn't
it?
It didn't have that tray. But there, you can get one on eBay. So I bought a replacement tray. I just saw the book behind the counter. I saw that bit of the book.
Right, right.
And I said, was there any pages missing from the book? He went, I've got the record in there somewhere. So the minute you open this up, it cracks and the pages fall out. But it seems to be complete.
There you go.
So I've put it together.
So is your shop open every day of the week?
No.
Nope.
No, not at all.
Is it open regular hours or as and when?
So well, we can give Thursday to Sunday.
Thursday to Sunday. And it's Parkway, right, in Camden?
88 basically. Parkway. Underneath Sands at Swing, you have to go to the back of the shop downstairs.
Which is basically right next door to the Dublin Castle.
Yep.
So if people want to come by and pick up a record, that's the best times of the week. Is it Thursday, yep. Friday, Saturday?
Yeah, I'm normally in on a Friday or Sunday.
Careful now, Boz.
I'll just wreck it then. But I thought I'd keep hold of that myself, really.
So is what we have here your personal collection?
Personal. There's things I pulled out of the shop. There's some progressive things, some reissues on the top. There's some stuff I played on. There's some rare things there that don't belong in the shop, really.
Is there any music you really don't like?
Not really. It's good and bad in everything.
The only genre that matters is quality, right?
Yeah. Yeah, I like that.
What's the rarest record you own?
It's in the safe.
Is it really?
Yeah.
I'm going to go make you I love that you have a safe for your records.
There's a few in the safe.
That's amazing. That is the sign of a true collector.
This is Midsummer Night's Scene by John's Children. But it also comes with the original label copies. And that shows that the B-side was originally going to be Jagged Time Lapse. That's faded now. That's the original label copy. With the Napier Bell production taken off.
Now, how often with a record like this would you actually get it out and play it?
I haven't played it for a while. I used to play it. And there's the adverts. So, I mean, it hasn't been played much. You can see it's pretty good condition. I used to have two. That's the old one. And then, yeah, that's the original that it was going to be on the 19th of June.
So how many of these are there in the world?
I might have seen five.
Five? One, two, wow, three. And the whole world?
I think that's very rare, and it's very collectible, and it's very expensive. But I think that this, no, not that, Japanese Mark Bolan, Hippie Gumbo. What's that? A lot. David Bowie's first record.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Liza Jane.
Davy Jones and the King Bees.
On Vocalion.
I like his mod stuff.
I do. I'd forgotten I had that. Oh, there's a Pink Floyd record in there. French Arnold Lane. Eager Boy by the Lonesome Drifter with a fantastic Teardrop Valley on the other side. They made about 200. I think it's near mint. Great rockabilly record. This is South African Desdemona, the only copy I've know of. Must have been a radio copy because it says Avoid on the label. Don't play it. So that, I don't know. Yeah, I can't put a value on it really. But they're the they're my.
They're the ones that are deemed worthy of being kept in the safe.
Yes, in
the forest. It makes them very special.
Yeah.
I love it. Well, Boz, thank you very much for your time. Thanks for having me over.
Lovely.
Should we go and get a little pint? After? Oh, you've got to do your interview first, haven't you?
Well, what's the time now?
1:30.
Well, I've got half an hour.
All right. Do you want to go and have a quick drink?
Yeah, we could do one.
All right. Nice one, mate. Put it there. Oh, and finally, Polecat shows. Are there any in the diary that you could tell us about before I let you go?
There's been a couple. There might be one at the Blues Kitchen in Camden. We've done that quite a lot, and it's quite an easy gig, and it always sounds good, and it's free to get in, and there's, I'm not sure when that might be, and there's penciled in one for the 100 Club at the end of the year, probably October, November.
And there's that all day one you're doing as well in Birmingham, right?
Yeah, but that's sold out.
Oh, that's gone.
Yeah, that's it's got every neo-rockabilly band in the that ever was, and
it's 20, sold out in minutes.
£20 a ticket,
right?
At the Irish Centre,
yeah, yeah, in Digbeth, yeah,
Digbeth, yeah. That sold out straight away.
Yeah,
and it's an amazing bill.
When is that? I might try and sneak into that.
I think it's June 7th.
June 7th, right on. And the website, if people want to go and keep up to date.
Polecat's got a Facebook. The shop. Vanna Boutique's got a Facebook.
And people can order from you online as well, can't they, if they can't make it into Camden?
Yeah, there's a. It does say that it's not secure, but because it goes through PayPal, it is secure with the payment.
I can vouch for him, ladies and gents. He's a trustworthy man. And the Morrissey album, California Cern, out later this year, potential tour. All right. Thanks,
lovely,
mate. Thanks.
Cheers.
For coming on.
Lovely.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.